Hello and welcome to Ukraine Calling, your weekly review of what's been happening in Ukraine with a focus on the main issue. I'm Kirill Lukarenko for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and here is a look at some of the stories that were in the news this week.
Recognize the strength and warmth of the relationship between the UK and the Ukraine. And I think we're celebrating 25 years of diplomatic cooperation between us, which is very good.
Somebody tried to call it as a frozen conflict. I want to deliver the information that this is absolutely not a frozen. This is a hot Russian aggression against my country.
Ничего, было сначала начали тарахтеть, а потом какие-то большие прилетели 4 или 5 штук и всё, и вот и произошло. Мы по дому побегали прятаться, куда не знали. Сильно страшно.
There are 8 ancient churches in the Ukrainian region of the Carpathians. Take a virtual tour of each of them and immerse yourself in the atmosphere of the past centuries with the virtual reality technology.
Ukraine's President Poroshenko in England. British Prime Minister Theresa May called for early parliamentary elections this Wednesday. She also welcomed Ukraine's President Poroshenko at 10 Downing Street the same day. In this rapidly changing international environment, Poroshenko is looking to maintain strong links with Ukraine's allies. May reassured the Ukrainian president that the UK stood ready to support Ukraine in the face of Moscow's aggression. That Brexit would not affect British-Ukrainian cooperation, and that she would insist that sanctions against Russia remain in place until the Minsk agreement was fully implemented. During his trip to London, Poroshenko also met with British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson and Armed Forces Minister Mike Penning. The main topics on Poroshenko's agenda were security, support for Ukraine, the war in the Donbas, enhancement of bilateral military cooperation, cybersecurity, and counteracting propaganda. He also talked about economic cooperation, simplifying visa requirements for Ukrainians, and technical assistance. Poroshenko's official website reported that plans were made to hold an international conference in London this July on reforms in Ukraine. Poroshenko also appeared on Sky News, where his main message was, "What's going on in Ukraine is not a frozen conflict, but hot Russian aggression against Ukraine." He cited casualty statistics. Later in the show, we'll look at where Ukraine fits in the picture of the changing international security environment in the feature interview with Brian Whitmore by Marta Dichok. International Court of Justice ruling. The International Court of Justice issued a ruling this week in Ukraine's case against Russia. The case was filed by Ukraine on January the 16th of this year. There were two parts to Ukraine's case. One was charging Russia with financing and sponsoring terrorism against Ukraine as a violation of the International Convention for the Suppression of the Financing of Terrorism. The other charged Russia with discriminatory activities in Crimea in violation of the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. The UN's highest court ruled in Ukraine's favor on the second part. The official wording is as follows. Quote, "The court finds that Russia must refrain from imposing limitations on the ability of the Crimean Tatar community to conserve its representative institutions, including the Mejlis, and ensure the availability of education in the Ukrainian language." The Hague, 9th April 2017, end quote. On the charge of Russia sponsoring terrorism, the court did not rule in Ukraine's favor. Here is the official wording. Quote, "The court is of the view that at this stage of the proceedings, Ukraine has not put before it evidence which affords a sufficient basis to find it plausible that these elements are present. Therefore, it concludes that the conditions required for the indication of provisional measures in respect of the rights alleged by Ukraine on the basis of the ICSFT are not met." End quote. We'll post a link to the court decision on our website. War. Easter was celebrated in Ukraine's war zone, despite the fact that the bombing and heavy shelling continued priests held services for soldiers all along the front lines. And on Easter Day, no Ukrainian soldiers were killed or wounded. Later in the week, the town of Avdiivka in Donetsk Oblast once again became the hot spot in the war zone. 8 residential buildings were destroyed by heavy bombardment on Tuesday, leaving residents homeless and neighborhoods without power. The town was a major coke and chemical works factory. We'll post a video on the attack on our website. During the past week, 10 Ukrainian servicemen were wounded. Innovation. Despite the war continuing in the eastern part of Ukraine, the country is continuing to innovate. An innovation park was opened in Kyiv earlier this month. The 25-hectare park is called Unit City and is modeled on Silicon Valley giants like Google and Apple. It aims to provide small and medium-sized businesses access to infrastructure necessary for rapid development by combining educational, business, cultural, medical, sports, and entertainment facilities at one site. The target audience are Ukrainian and international companies in areas of high technology, creative ideas, and innovative business, R&D centers, startups, and IT companies. The project plans to create 15,000 highly paid jobs for Ukrainians and prevent further brain drain from the country. And now we are bringing you a feature about Ukraine and its place in the global security system. Marta Dychok interviews Brian Whitmore, journalist from the Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty.
Brian Whitmore is the top international Russia analyst. He is an expert on Ukraine and Eastern Europe and the entire post-Soviet space. Brian has lived and worked in Russia and Ukraine. He's currently based in Prague, where he works for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, where he is the author of the very popular Power Vertical podcast that informs international audiences about Russia daily. He's regularly invited to speak at international security conferences and was recently in Tbilisi, Georgia. Mr. Whitmore, thank you very much for finding the time to speak to us.
Thank you for having me.
Brian, we're living in a world where the international security situation is very much in flux. It feels like the ground is shifting under our feet. Where does Ukraine fit into this picture?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I'm having this debate, this ongoing debate with myself, whether we're reliving the 1970s, which were a difficult time, or whether we're reliving the 1930s. Which was a catastrophic time. And up until recently, I thought it was the 70s. I said, okay, the West has been through this before. We had this period of self-doubt that afflicted the West in the 1970s following the Vietnam War. Europe and America both were beginning to doubt the viability of their institutions. And we came out of that a lot stronger. We know how that movie ended, right? There's also this risk, and I've been increasingly worried about this, that we might be repeating something closer to the 1930s, which represents kind of an existential threat to our way of life. And to answer this, I want to step back a little bit and get not philosophical, but kind of broaden the aperture a little bit and talk a little bit about civilization. Because when we think about what makes civilization possible, what does make civilization possible? It's our ability to tell each other stories, right? We tell each other stories that we all believe. These stories are intersubjective, but they only work if we all believe them. I mean, think about money, right? Money is a piece of paper with colors and numbers and dead people on it. But you can bring it to the store and people will give you stuff for it. Why do they do that? Well, they do that because we all believe in the value of this thing called money. And this can be said about religion, about the state, about all sorts of stories we tell each other that bind human communities together, allow them to form civilizations and cooperate on a broad scale in a very flexible way. Now, Western civilization has told a series of very, very compelling stories, that individuals have rights, that the government should be accountable to the governed, that democratic elections are the only form of legitimacy, that small states have the right to sovereignty that is no less sacrosanct than big states, for example. We tell each other all of these very compelling stories and more, and this has formed the basis of Western civilization. We're in a point right now where a hostile outside power, and I don't think we need to name the Russian Federation by name, is trying to cause us to question our stories. And this is a big risk because this is coming at a time when the West is going through one of its cycles of periodic self-doubt. This is kind of a natural organic process that happens in the West. Like I said, it happened in the 70s, it happened in the 30s. It's happening again now. Where we're questioning ourselves. And this in and of itself isn't bad, but when you have an outside power at that time trying to cause us to question our own values, question our own stories, the stories that make our institutions possible, well, that's potentially very, very, very dangerous. And then I think we're seeing that right now. Now, where does Ukraine fit into this picture? Ukraine's actually very important in this picture, as is Georgia. Because as the West is doubting the viability of its own institutions, doubting the viability of its own stories, as the European Union is questioning its the viability of the European Union, you have Ukrainians who are literally dying to get in, who are literally right now dying to be part of our story, right? And so I think Ukraine is a very important part of this story. And in a lot of ways, it should be a reality check for those of us in the West. You're right. I was in Tbilisi last week at a conference speaking. And it was funny, when I came back to Prague, I had dinner with a bunch of Czech friends, and we're talking about the malaise that's set in Europe and this lack of confidence in the European Union. I said, you know, the city I was just in, people would be dying to have your problems. Literally, and elsewhere, people literally are dying to have the problems that Europe is having. So I think Ukraine fits into this very well, because it shows that the Western story, which is expansionist, the Russians are right about that, but they're wrong about how it's expansionist. It's expansionist in a voluntary way. It's expansionist because it's an attractive story, and it's an attractive story that others want to be part of. And Ukraine and Georgia are very important components of that right now. And I think we need to recognize that.
Well, perhaps open to enlargement rather than expansionist. But I thank you for placing Ukraine in that story narrative. That's an interesting way of looking at it. I was recently reading an article about the role of emotion in international affairs, and how emotions can trump reason very often. Anger, frustration, fear. These are strong driving forces in the formulation of international security policy. What factors do you see driving international affairs security questions at the moment?
I mean, I think, and I'm surely not the first to say this, but I think we are in a situation where our hopes are competing with our fears, right? Our hopes are competing with our fears. And as I said before, the West is going through this period of self-doubt, where our fears generated by a lot of very real things. I mean, the Iraq war undermined our faith in our institutions. The 2008 financial crisis undermined our faith in institutions. The ensuing financial crisis in the European Union undermined our faith in institutions. The migrant crisis in Europe is undermining people's faith in institutions and heightening people's fear. And whenever you have this heightened sense of fear, you're going to have politicians who are going to try to exploit it and try to appeal to people's fears. We have elections coming up in France this weekend, which I think very starkly illustrate this. We have an election later this year in Germany that very starkly illustrates this. But if you look over the course of the last year, from the U.S. election to the Brexit campaign to the campaign now in France, you're seeing this struggle between hopes and fears. And temporarily, it did look like our fears were winning. But I'm an optimist at the end of the day, and I think, at the end of the day, our hopes are going to win. Although I do fear, to use that word again, that we maybe may risk repeating something like the 1930s, I still do believe we're going through something like the 70s, and that we can get through this. But we have to remember to trust our stories, because our stories are good stories. And the West has a good story to tell. It's a story that, like I said, others badly want to be part of that story. People in Ukraine certainly want to be part of that story. And that should tell you something.
Well, you've framed a lot of what you've said in terms of emotion. And I guess the question I'm wondering about is, where is the role of reason in all of this? That a lot of institutions are based on ideas, not so much emotions, but ideas, beliefs that, you know, human rights are important, that, as you said, every state has the right to self-determination. And these are intellectual constructs. I see a lack of new ideas in how to get out of the current international crisis we seem to be facing. And what other factors other than emotion do you see playing a role in what's happening in the international security environment?
Well, I don't think you can separate entirely the beliefs and emotions. I believe very deeply in the institutions of Western democracy, right? Intellectually, I believe very deeply in the viability of the U.S. Constitution, but I also have an emotional attachment to these things. I have an emotional attachment because I believe in these things. And that's not just an intellectual process. That's also an affective process. It's an emotional process. So I don't think you can completely separate those things from each other. But I've been thinking a little bit about history in a lot of this. And I've been thinking a lot about 1947, for example, because I think
47? What happens in 47?
47 is the real beginning of the Cold War.
Ah.
47 is the year that policy of containment came into effect. And people, history doesn't repeat itself. Sometimes it rhymes, sometimes it doesn't. But we can look to history for some kind of guidance. And if you look back to 47, you see, well, why was the West able to survive an onslaught at that time against its values, which is coming from the Soviet Union, after the Great Depression, after the Second World War, when it was quite a risky time. And there were two elements that kind of came into play. One was the policy of containment, of course, which is outlined in George Kennan's famous Mr. X article in Foreign Affairs, and before that in the Long Telegram. But the other side of that, and this is something that's often neglected, is the establishment of the social welfare state in Europe and North America. Because what that did was it took away the rougher edges of Western liberal capitalism and stole from the Soviet Union the ability to undermine it. And I think, and over the last several decades, we have slowly but surely, step by step, cut back on the social welfare state in both Europe and in North America. And this has left a large disenfranchised working class vulnerable to these kind of appeals that we're seeing coming from Moscow right now. And they're appealing directly to the fringes, left and right, in Europe and North America. So I think there's things that the Western left and the Western right need to admit right now. And that the Western left, which doesn't like to say the policy containment worked, needs to admit that the policy of containment did in fact work. And the Western right, which doesn't like to admit that the social welfare state basically saved Western capitalism, need to admit that, yes, it did indeed help save Western capitalism. So I think we need this kind of two-pronged approach. Now, this is difficult now, because one of the reasons the West cut back on the welfare state, containment's easier to do. Step back for a second. Containment's easier to do, because we've basically done that before. We just have to update it to the 20th century. Russia's not only using kinetic means, forceful means to undermine the West, but they're also using non-kinetic tactics, such as information warfare, the weaponization of organized crime, the weaponization of corruption, the weaponization of international finance. And we need to be much more vigilant about these kinds of things. So we need a containment for the 21st century needs to be a whole of government approach. It doesn't just include the military arms of government, but the non-military arms as well. Law enforcement, regulatory agencies, and so on and so forth. We need to tighten up our money laundering laws. We need to really keep an eye on corruption, because I've said before, corruption is the new communism. The Kremlin's black cash is the new red menace. I repeat though that line always, and anybody that's heard me before is probably rolling their eyes right now because I say this all the time. But I say it all the time for a reason, because it's true. Now so we can do containment. Now the real tricky part, I think, is revamping the social welfare state for an age of globalization. Because how do you create a social welfare state
in a globalized world?
In a globalized world where capital can move to where it's going to be, you know, taxed the lowest and regulated the lowest. And that's very, 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 very tricky. But I'm sure there are some smart economists out there that can start thinking about this. Because last time around, this was half of the equation that basically saved the West. So this is something that I think, these are two things I think we need to start thinking about. Another thing we need to start thinking about, and this concerns Ukraine and Georgia and Moldova and all the neighborhood countries on Russia's periphery that, in the case of Ukraine and Georgia, by large margins want to be part of the West. Moldova is more divided, a little bit more complicated. But we have to find a way to bring these countries into the West in a way that's doable. I think we need to start being, the West needs to start being much more honest with our Ukrainian and Georgian partners right now. Because we hear, and I hear it at every international conference I attend, that the NATO's door is always open to anybody who wants to join. Yes, okay, that sounds nice, right?
Those are just words, though.
But you and I both know that right now, Ukraine's not getting into NATO anytime soon. Georgia's not getting into NATO anytime soon. Ukraine's not getting into the EU anytime soon. Georgia's not getting into the EU anytime soon. Large majorities of Ukraine and Georgia may want to join the EU, and slimmer majorities of Ukraine and large majority in Georgia want to join NATO. But I guarantee large majorities of NATO and the EU do not want to take these two countries in right now. I don't think that's right. But that's the reality on the ground. And so what do we do right now? And I think the association agreement Georgia and Ukraine have recently just signed with the EU is a step in the right direction. The visa-free travel is a step in the right direction because there's a real risk right now. There's a window of opportunity right now where Ukraine and Georgia are extremely pro-Western and really want to be part of the Western family. And the West is kind of keeping them at arm's length. And there's a danger that there's going to be a backlash in these societies and we're going to lose this opportunity. I think that keeping the West needs to show that it's going to welcome those that want to play by its rules, share in its stories, and be part of the Western family. I think that's very important for all of our security right now, let alone being morally correct.
Well, maybe I could just interrupt you here, Brian. Sorry. You've been presenting it from the perspective of the West, Western institutions, but let's reframe this. How would you assess Ukraine's actions in the foreign policy arena over the past, say, 3 years?
I mean, I think Ukraine has played a very bad hand very, very well, to be honest, in the foreign policy arena. I mean, if you look at where things looked in 2014, it looked pretty bleak. And Ukraine has been, I mean, largely thanks to the surprising strength of the Ukrainian armed forces, the surprising strength of Ukrainian society, you've basically fought Russia to a draw. And that's no small accomplishment. Right. So I think the Ukrainian authorities have been pretty good at presenting Ukraine's case in the West. Where I think Ukraine's coming up short is in domestic politics, because this is as much a battle of governance than it is a war on the battlefield and a part of international diplomacy. This is a battle of governance. Ukraine wants to be part of the West. Being part of the West means certain things in terms of transparency, fighting corruption, and so on and so forth. And I think in this area, particularly the recent NGO law that was passed, I see Ukraine coming up a little bit short here. Perhaps that's too critical, but I think, ironically, this is where the Ukrainian authorities do have the power to do what they need to do without Russian interference. It doesn't depend on what the West wants to do. I think what Ukraine needs to do is to take a lesson from Estonia. Take a lesson from Estonia. Rewind the clock back to 1991, the breakup of the USSR. Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, all three of the Baltics, wanted very much to join Western institutions. And Western institutions were not very thrilled with that idea at that time, if you remember correctly, right? What the three Baltic states did, and Estonia in particular, was to make it literally impossible for the West to say no. The Estonians became more European than the Europeans, reformed their economy, pretty much didn't eradicate corruption, but they score pretty high on global anti-corruption indexes right now, and made it just simply impossible for the West to say no. In terms of NATO, NATO did not want to accept the Baltic states at that point. And they created things, they kept making the Baltics jump through hoops. Like they created the institution of MAP, Membership Action Plan, right? Something we all know about now. Do we know how this thing, this institution was created? It was created basically as a bunch of hoops for the Baltic states to jump through. And the feeling was, they're never going to jump through these hoops. Well, guess what? They jumped through every single one of those hoops. So what Ukraine needs to do is to kind of take a page out of that book and look at what they, what Ukraine can do that it has control over, and that can make itself as attractive to the West as possible. So I think, my guess to answer your question, sure, it's mixed. I think on one hand, Ukraine's played a very bad hand, very, very well. And on the other hand, I think at times, particularly in the domestic arena, they've shot themselves in the foot.
So containment has been successful. Building a welfare state has not been successful in Ukraine, to refer to your earlier answer.
That's actually, I didn't think of it that way, but that's interesting. I mean, I was thinking more in terms of broader domestic politics than just the welfare state. But I guess to have a successful welfare state, you do have to have a relatively transparent form of governance. You have to minimalize corruption to the extent as possible. And again, as I said before, corruption is a national security issue for Ukrainians more than anybody. Corruption is a national security issue because again, Russia's weaponized corruption, and every corrupt deal is basically empowers the Kremlin.
Brian, you're a top analyst of international affairs. If you were Ukrainian President Poroshenko's foreign policy advisor, what would you be telling him to do right now in the medium term and in the long term?
I would be telling him to focus on reforming Ukraine's domestic economy. Well, I think that's job number one. I think this is what Ukraine must do first and foremost. I think the conflict...
Can I push you on that a little bit? That's sure. I think most people would agree with that. But fighting corruption, how does one do that? I mean, you're a foreign policy expert, not a domestic policy, but... You know, the instruments to fight corruption. Ukraine has set up a number of institutions. They've tried to change personnel in various institutions. What are other instruments to actually fight corruption? And again, it's both a domestic and international dimension because Ukraine is part of a global economy now.
I think that you first and foremost, you have to have absolutely independent courts. Absolutely independent courts. You have to have prosecutors who are not subject to political pressure. And you have to have the political will to really eradicate this. And people at the top who are corrupt need to be prosecuted. I mean, this is why I say I'm seeing some positive steps, but I think we need to see more because I think this again, is the most important thing. This war of governance is extremely important. Ukraine needs to make itself attractive to the West. And Ukraine has to minimize the levers that Moscow can have to undermine its domestic progress, right? So, I mean, I've read many times that Moscow's plan B now is to try to undermine Ukraine through the oligarchs. Well, I think this is something we have to be very, very mindful and vigilant about. I don't know if this is happening yet, but I think it's something that we need to be very, very mindful of because we basically have a struggle between two, we don't have a Cold War right now, but we have a struggle between two normative systems, one to the West that's based on all these things we hold near and dear, the rule of law, the rights of the individual, the sanctity of contracts, transparency, and so on, and one to the East that's based on a whole different set of values, patron-client relationships, the subordination of law to power, the corruption as an integral part of politics. These two normative systems are competing with each other. And Ukraine, not just in words, but in deeds and in very demonstrative deeds, needs to demonstrate which side of that divide it's on. I got a strong sense of where the Ukrainian people are on this. I get a strong sense of where Ukrainian civil society is on this. But I think it's time for the Ukrainian authorities to catch up to their civil society on this. Because one of the hallmarks of the Ukrainian story is the gap between the civil society, which is extremely advanced, and the elite, which is not as post-Soviet as it was a decade ago or even 5 years ago, but is still showing signs of that. The Ukrainian authorities have to become as good as Ukrainian civil society. And that is the single most important national security advice I would give to any Ukrainian leader.
Given the changes we're seeing in the United States after the election of Donald Trump, how do I phrase this politely? The non-corrupt West with a belief in institutions and rule of law, that seems to be coming under question. And corruption and disregard for procedure seems to be increasingly visible in Washington. Where does that international picture leave us if we've got corruption in Russia, we've got a seemingly major change in style of politics, substance of politics in the U.S. Where do you see, if you had a crystal ball, how do you see the sort of the international environment unfolding over the next year, the next 5 years?
Well,
I don't know if you want to speculate, but I just thought I'd throw that out there.
We Americans are taught from birth that we're a nation of laws, not men or not people, that our institutions are more important than any single president or any single Congress. And this is being tested right now. But I'll tell you what, so far what I see is I'm pretty encouraged because American institutions seem to be working right now. And so we're not seeing the nightmare scenario many people had envisioned at this point. The American civil society is pushing back. American institutions are pushing back. The American media is pushing back. The American courts are pushing back. Even to an extent, the American Congress is pushing back. So I'm not sure I would write off the U.S. just yet. In foreign affairs, we're not seeing the kind of foreign policy so far that everybody had expected to see following the election. We're seeing America kind of revert to, in a lot of ways, its traditional foreign policy. You're seeing the foreign policy establishment seeming to take control of the situation. So I'm not sure where this is going to go, but so far, the signs have been more encouraging than I dared hope.
Tillerson's visit to Moscow recently, what Ukraine almost didn't come up in it except in the context of Crimea. But you're right, it was very much sort of going back to old foreign policy.
Yeah, no, it seems like it's going back to the default setting. And I think that, again, America has geopolitical interests and the American foreign policy establishment has values that transcend any single president, regardless of which direction he or she would like to go. I think that we have this image of the American president as this all-powerful figure, when the fact of the matter is the American president is quite limited by design, by the genius of our Constitution. I'm less apocalyptic about this than I was. What does worry me a bit is that you may have a lack of American attention to places like Ukraine and Georgia right now.
That comment by Tillerson, why should the U.S. taxpayer be interested in Ukraine?
Well, yeah, and there's answers to that. But yeah, the problem that you're just not going to have the level of attentiveness that you have. And that Moscow's looking for this. Moscow's hoping that the U.S. will not be attentive to this part of the world and that will, if not explicitly give it a freer hand, at least implicitly give it a freer hand. But I don't see that happening right now. I think you have powerful voices in the U.S. that care a lot about what happens in the European neighborhood. I mean, Ukraine and Georgia, certainly in the Baltic states. You see NATO basically has become revived, and this has not slowed down as a result of the U.S. election. A U.S. troop presence in the Baltic states now, or a NATO troop presence, a U.S., Canadian, British troop presence in the Baltic states now. Did I leave anybody out there?
No.
I don't want to.
I think you covered them all. Yeah.
But these are encouraging signs. I still believe in our stories. I think although our stories are coming under a degree of assault right now, I think our stories will persevere in the long run.
Well, it sounds like the story that Ukraine needs to decide is where it wants to be. Russia needs to decide where it wants to be.
I think they both have decided. I think Ukrainian society has clearly decided where it wants to be. If I can believe the poll numbers and believe what I see when I do visit Ukraine and what I hear, I think that this is the most telling thing of the last several years, is Ukraine has made its choice. It is now the easternmost Western country rather than the westernmost Eastern country. And that's despite the problems. And I think that's an important choice. The trick now is for Ukraine's leaders to catch up with its society.
I don't know that Russia has decided on its story. I think, to use your parallel, Russia's leadership is very vocal in its statements. I wonder what Russian society is thinking and which story it wants. And I think part of Ukraine's leadership is very much on the European page, on the international page. The corruption is something that needs to be sorted out. But if we look at Italy, if we look at various other countries, corruption is a problem in many, many places. Mm-hmm. But you've given us a very reasonable and in many ways hopeful picture for the future. It doesn't look as uncertain as perhaps it did a year ago. Is there anything you'd like to add, Brian?
Maybe just on your issue of where Russian society is, that's a very good question, because it is very much in flux right now, and it's very paradoxical in a lot of ways, because you look at 2/3 of Russians hold Putin personally responsible for corruption. You have truckers' protests over a road tax, the money which is going to a Putin crony. You had on March 26th, you had massive nationwide demonstrations against corruption. They were called by opposition figure Alexei Navalny. But yet, Putin's popularity is in the stratosphere. It's over 80%. Now, how do you square this paradox? It's kind of weird. And there was a very interesting piece today in republik.ru by the political analyst Tatiana Stanovaya, which explained it as follows. She said, basically, expressing support for Putin is almost a ritual right now. It's ritualistic. It's not an active expression of support, but it's just kind of this passive acquiescence in the situation, and also driven by a fear that things could get worse. And I think that's very true. But what that made me think of is that it's very similar to the late Soviet period, when support for the regime was this empty ritual. And we know where that led, right? So it's a very, very delicate time in Russia right now. And it's almost like we're continuing the story that we had from 2011, when the Putin regime looked like it was really in grave danger in 2011, 2012. Now, that, of course, was changed by the war in Ukraine, by the annexation of Crimea. The metaphor I've used for that is it's like that Putin basically drugged the population with this euphoric drug called Crimea, right? It's like he gave the society a collective hit of cocaine or something. But you know, what all drugs do is they wear off. And I think this is wearing off right now. The question is, when the drug wears off, well, the addict goes for another hit, right? Because they're dependent on that drug. And this worries me a little bit, that as this regime feels threatened, it's going to seek a new foreign adventure, a new drug to whip the society back into this state of patriotic euphoria. The Crimea drug was pretty powerful. I don't know what's going to be as powerful as that. But this has got me worried a little bit. But there's some very interesting trends in Russian society right now that merit watching. Navalny's already called for nationwide protests on the 12th of June. So it's promising to be a pretty hot summer. But the domestic Russian politics story is coming back. I wasn't really paying as much attention to Russian domestic politics in the last few years because foreign affairs have been so dominant. But now the fact that domestic politics seems to be coming back into the equation. Russia's facing an election next year. This is the centennial of the Bolshevik Revolution, which is causing a lot of worries in the Kremlin because they don't really know how to frame this. They've staged themselves as anti-colored revolution. That's been their identity for so long. Well, guess what? The first colored revolution wasn't orange.
It was red.
That's right. It happened in St. Petersburg, Putin's hometown. So, I mean, they're having a lot of trouble framing this. And this is all happening as they're preparing for elections next year, which they hope to be just a coronation of Putin. They switched the election date to the anniversary of the annexation of Crimea to kind of, you know, milk that for all it's worth. But at the same time, we're seeing truckers protest. We're seeing protests in the regions over wage arrears. And we're seeing this wave of generated by Navalny of protests against corruption. This is beginning to resonate. And it's certainly merits watching. Now, I don't know if that means Russia, that does not mean that Russia's shifting into a Western direction. The decline of this regime does not automatically translate into a pro-Western Russia. I don't think that's the case at all.
Well, anti-corruption is a universal sort of emotion.
Exactly.
It's not,
exactly.
But it's a, yeah. I think, a positive trend. So I guess to summarize what you've said, we see a clash between emotion and reason and very tight relations between domestic and foreign policies,
yes,
both in Russia and Ukraine and in other countries. We've been speaking with Brian Whitmore from Prague, who is the host and author of The Power Vertical for RFARL, so watch for that. And I'm Marta Dechok for Hromadske Radio. Thanks for listening.
Culture. A Baba Halamaha celebrated its 25th birthday this week. It's a Ukrainian publishing house set up by the poet Ivan Malkovich back in 1992, just after Ukraine became independent. He started off publishing children's book, and the first post-communist generation of children grew up reading beautifully produced books in Ukrainian. The company later expanded into translation and adult literature and keeps winning national and international awards. It brought the Harry Potter series to Ukraine audiences in the Ukrainian languages. Malkovich was particularly proud that the popular series was available in Ukrainian before it was translated in Russia. They now produce interactive books that can be read on your iPad, and their Ukrainian books have been translated into many languages. This year, Malkovich received the prestigious Shevchenko Prize for Poetry, and his publishing company Party was held at the Taras Shevchenko Museum in central Kyiv. If you would like to see how much fun it was, we'll post a link to a video of the party on our website. Google is helping promote tourism in Ukraine and Poland. It has just released a virtual tour of the UNESCO World Heritage List of wooden churches in the Carpathian Mountain region in the west of the country. 8 of the churches are in Ukraine, another 8 are in Poland. A video with 3D tours narrated in English explaining the history and culture of the churches was produced by Google Ukraine in cooperation with Ukraine's Culture Ministry. The churches are also available on Google Street View. For those more interested in contemporary culture, Ukraine is gearing up to host the 2017 Eurovision contest next month. This week, the hosts of the extravaganza were announced: Volodymyr Ostapchuk, Oleksandr Skichko, and Timur Miroshnichenko. They held a press conference and promised lots of surprises. Scriptwriters for the contest have already started arriving from London for the preparations. And they will have seen the new exhibit in Kyiv International Airport, which just opened. It's a project called Prominent Ukrainians, and it aims to depict Ukrainian history and culture through contemporary graphic art. It was first exhibited in the Ukrainian Presidential Administration buildings, but now will be shown to a wider international audience. The co-author of the project, Gennady Kurochko, said that he hopes thousands of selfies will be taken next to these images as international visitors pass through the airport. And that will, quote, spread information about the bright Ukrainian culture throughout the globe, end quote. Music. People continue to write and perform songs even during war. This week, there is a new song for you by the guitar bandura duo Inglia. They are from Dimir, a small town in Kyiv Oblast. It's called Pisnya pro Lyubov, which means a song about love. The refrain has these lyrics. Quote, regardless if it's thundering or raining, if the war's going on and blood continues to be spilled, this song will be about love. End quote. Enjoy.
Чи то грім гримить, чи то дощ іде, чи козак коня додому веде. Чи пішла війна, чи шелеться кров, а ця пісня буде про любов, пісня про любов. Бачили очі світанки, зорі ловили в ставках, з вечора і до ранку руки плелись по руках.
І світ
Лавина. Чи то грім гримить, чи то дощ іде, чи козак коня додому веде. Чи пішла війна, чи шелеться кров, а ця пісня буде про любов.
Його поцілунок останній, і обіцяний я повернусь. Птахою на прощання вирвалося з них лошами.
Довгі роки пролетіли, та звісток від нього нема. За ним полетіти хотіла, до той, що в полоні трима. Чи то грім гримить, чи то дощ іде, чи козак коня додому веде. Чи пішла війна, чи шелеться кров, а ця пісня буде про.
Коли вже покинула віра,
і чекати не було вже сил,
звістка таки прилетіла.
Я живий, ти богів попроси,
скоріш повернутись до мене,
і в обіймах твоїх утону. Та й більше нічого не треба, лиш до себе тебе пригорнуть. Чи то грім гримить, чи то дощ іде, чи козак коня додому веде. Чи пішла війна, чи шелеться кров, а ця пісня буде про любов. Чи то грім гримить, чи то дощ іде, чи козак коня додому веде. Чи пішла війна, шелеться кров, а ця пісня буде про любов, пісня про любов.
Looking forward, as the weather starts to get warmer, many of you might already be thinking about your summer travel plans. We'll be bringing to you a feature episode about travel in Ukraine soon. As next week, as always, we'll have more stories and current events. Tune in for a new episode, and we'd love to hear from you. Write to us at ukrainiancalling@hromadskyradio.org. I'm Kirill Lukarenko for Hromadsky Radio in Kyiv. Thanks for listening.